Celeb Savant is a career retrospective type interview focusing on singers, actors, and industry experts. Join Barrett Edelstein now as he dives into the entertainment world.
South African band Mango Groove has enjoyed over 12 number one hits and received every conceivable South African music and video award, as well as a number of global ones. They have set new precedents for South African artists by being the only South African group to sell out the Sun City Super Bowl and Standard Bank Arena 6 times. The first to redefine live staging and production standards for South African artists. The first to command R1 million sponsorship deal, and the first and only group to remain at the top of the South African national sales charts for over a year. Internationally, Mango Groove's unique and magical blend of South African marabi, kwela and pop influences, together with the voice and presence of Claire Johnston and the evocative sound of the penny whistle, have captivated audiences around the world. Career highlights include a direct satellite link-up to the Freddie Mercury tribute in London, a performance in front of 200,000 people at the SOS Racism concert in Paris, a performance at the renowned Montreux Jazz Festival where the band received 3 encores. The band was given the honor of being the only African act to be invited to perform at the Celebrate Hong Kong 97 reunification concert. And the band was also especially proud to have been associated with ABC Worldwide broadcasts of Nelson Mandela's release from prison, and the band went on to headline the performances at his inauguration a few years later. Up next on Celeb Savant, discussing the band's 40th anniversary and their upcoming event to celebrate this, is Claire Johnston.
Where are you in the world and how are you doing?
I am in Parkhurst in Johannesburg and I'm doing very well, thank you so much. How about you?
I am doing beautifully, thank you. Claire, how, where, and what was the name Mango Groove chosen?
You see, now I'm the wrong person to ask that question. I have the answer for you, but it's nothing to do with me.
Okay.
So Mango Groove was born out of a punk band called Pit Frog with 2 T's. And John Layden is the founding member of Mango Groove and one of the founding members of Pit Frog. And he had always been obsessed with kwela and marabi music. And I think at a certain point, when he was, you know, he was, I think, 17, 18, 19 when Pit Frog started, he bumped into Big Boy's Jack LaRola, who was an amazing exponent of kwela music, playing the bugle penny whistle. And it's at that point that John had the idea of letting this punk thing become something slightly different. And I think he was having a fairly, dare I say it, drunken lunch at the family home. And there was talk of what is this new entity going to be called? And they were checking around things like, it needs to be tropical, it needs to be fun, it needs to be, you know, fruity. And I guess when you choose a band name, you don't know how long it's going to go on for. You don't know it's going to go on 40 years, do you? Like last 3 months. And they came up with, I think, things like Mangrove and, you know, Tropical Groove and Mango Grove and then settled on Mango Groove. So that's my version of things as I've heard relayed to me over the years.
Heading to your story, at what age, whether as a child or teenager, did you think, okay, I want to be in this world creating music? How did that journey progress and how did you meet the rest of the band to join the band?
I guess my love affair with music started as a very young child. I was brought up on the music of Ella Fitzgerald and Shirley Bassey and Louis Armstrong and, you know, great songs, great singers, great brass players, trumpeters. Fast forward many years, my parents had divorced, my father had gone back to England, mom and I stayed here. And I saw an advertisement in the newspaper, I was 10 at this point, looking for little girls to be in a show called Annie. And I said, Mom, I have to go, I really want to go. And my mom was understandably very anxious about it. She just said, Claire, you're inexperienced, it's going to be these little Shirley Temple kind of girls. You're not going to get, she just was frightened. I was just going to get my heart broken. But I got in. I got in, there were lots of auditions, and I got into the show, and the show traveled around the country. I was 10, going into 11. And it became clear that this is something I really could consider as a career. So fast forward even further. and I'm in and out of school shows. I've done the odd other professional production, always playing an orphan. And I'm having singing lessons with the late amazing Eve Boswell. And one of the guys in the band calls her looking for, quote unquote, her best female singer. And she sends me. And that's how it began for me. But it was an inauspicious beginning. I'd seen the band perform already. I'd seen them, I was in my final year of school. I was 17. I'd gone to the Victory People's concert with a group of school friends. And I saw this band. By the time I got to the front of the stage, there was this military lineup of people. And I liked the music. I thought this is kind of cool. But I was also thinking, well, where's the singer? There was no focal point. So little did I know that in a month's time, I was going to get a call from the band looking for a singer. And when I did get the call, and I went and met the band, and I thought they were very cool. I was particularly impressed by the sort of jazz cats, you know, Mickey Vilakazi, Banza Khaswane, proper jazz musicians. Mickey Vilakazi, for instance, had served in World War II in the entertainment corps. You know, he had proper pedigree. And he was in his 60s and I was 17. And I thought there was something really interesting about that. Fast forward even further, I don't hear from the band. They've met me. They've just met me. They haven't heard me sing. Fast forward, I get a call from John. We have a gig this coming weekend. Can you rehearse for the next 2 nights? And my mum was, as ever, very, very understanding. And yes, I could. I get to the rehearsal room and I'm very overwhelmed to meet everybody, but there's no microphone. So what I'm really getting to is the first time they ever heard me sing was at the Abbey, which is, you know, interesting.
It was an amalgamation of people, cultures, music, bringing people together, obviously during a time in South Africa's history, which was very trying and very negative and so forth.
Dangerous even. Yeah.
Exactly. Dangerous. Being a cross-cultured, cross-race band, was there any resistance that you guys faced from record labels, from radio, from anyone in particular that was sort of a door closing that you had to find another route to progress further?
It's interesting, though. I mean, yes and no. I think at the time that I joined the band, so that's, you're talking about 1985, the band had been in existence for a year. It was at the height of apartheid era to some degree in that there was a state of emergency. But at the same time, things were coming to light where people were starting to sort of rebel, push back against it properly, I think. And we had a record deal quite quickly. And we recorded a few songs. We were on the radio. It wasn't so much that. I would say it was more venue-related, logistically related. For instance, John Layden, the founding member, was arrested on a pass offense. They tell kids today that you could be arrested for being in the wrong area at the wrong time because of the curve of your skin. They won't sort of believe you, but that's how it was. And John ended up in the cells in Soweto, and his mom had to come and bail him out the next day because he was dropping Jack home after 9 o'clock. So that sort of thing was an issue. And, you know, traveling was an issue. And I think that's what the lyrics in Hellfire are really all about. It's that there's a roadblock late at night and a military man can see that we're together, but he doesn't understand because he's literally like, well, what are you guys doing together? You know, black and white South Africans, what are you actually doing? This has to be nefarious. And of course, it was just musicians doing what they do.
Were you personally and the band surprised at the success, or was it just the building foundations and blocks that you carried on building and that was the next step?
No, we were absolutely gobsmacked. I mentioned that in 85, we got a record deal and we did end up on the radio, a couple of singles. That record didn't ever get released properly. We then got another record deal where we dabbled a little bit with bubblegum and disco. And that didn't get released, I think in large part because we didn't like it. But then, the right thing happened for us at the right time. In 1988, we were approached by a bunch of people who had some money to spend, proper money, to create a proper international standard album. This got released in 89. And by then, you know, I'd been with the band 4 years at this point. We'd had so many false starts. It was just another album. When I say just another album that maybe wouldn't get released.
Yes.
We had no idea what we were, you know, what was in store. We were blown away with the response. It was crazy. I mean, we were played across the board on every radio station. Back in the day, there weren't that many radio stations. We were everywhere. You couldn't escape Mango Groove. So we were astonished. We honestly thought it would be family and friends buying the album.
You referenced that you had a number of false starts. And obviously, being in the entertainment industry, even after the success, there are ups and downs and challenges. People see person A is popular, the in thing, and then they're no longer relevant because of certain things. For you personally, how have you navigated and overcome those sorts of challenges in your life?
That's such a great question because, you know, when you've been crazily successful, I mean, as in, you know, we were number one at the top of the charts for over a year. Now, that doesn't happen anymore simply because of the way we consume music and everything moves so quickly now.
Yes. But
you're right. So we were everywhere and everyone was praising us. And then that sort of love affair over time sort of dissipates. And as you say, new styles of music come in. Grunge came in. I'm personally a massive grunge fan. I guess you have to, as you say, navigate that. What does it mean for you? And I think the trick as an artist is to stay true to your roots, stay true to what you believe in and what works for you, what's credible to you, and not to suddenly, you know, fake it. And I think that's probably one of the reasons that we have lasted as long as we have, is that we've stuck to our guns through the good and the bad times.
Let's unpack the creative process of writing those hit songs. How did they come to be?
It was always quite messy. So Mango's 11 people now. When I joined, I think we were 7 or 8. And songs would sometimes be written around a brass line or a bass line or a lyrical hook. And then we would all add little bits and pieces. So it was always fairly messy. And then you have songs which challenge that sort of thing, where John, for instance, wrote Another Country with Alan. Alan did a lot of the instrumentation. But John wrote those lyrics literally having seen footage of the Boy Patong massacre in 1993. So you've got that sort of heartfelt, I'm on my own feelings thing. And then he'd still bring it and workshop it to some degree. And then it would be the sort of chaos in the rehearsal room. What's anyone got? This is interesting. And bear in mind that very first album, we'd road tested those songs. For instance, the songs like Dance Some More, Home Talk, Special Star to some degree, we'd played them live. And as a result, you know, they sort of work. So that's always a big help.
We're celebrating 40 years. Are you surprised by the legacy of the band and the influence of the music over all these decades?
I really am, if I'm honest. Obviously, it's a time for reflection. You know, you look back at 40 years and I do. That's why I'm able to tell you with clarity, remember about being 17 and joining the band, because I've been thinking about these things and little knowing that this would become the environment in which I grew up. You know, I grew up in the band. I was a child. No, I mean, I looking back to being a 17-year-old, you know, young girl joining this band that went on to travel the world and that still does shows and, you know, we're attracting young audiences. And I would never have guessed that in a million years. And I think we're above all very grateful. Yeah, it's incredible. 40 years, I can't quite wrap my head around that. I don't feel 40 myself.
I totally agree with you, but the problem with society these days is they put something on a number that does not exist. So they say they this age means now they can't do this, or it means this should happen, or means that. And it's a lot of nonsense.
Yeah.
You can be as old or young as you want to be. And I often say when people say, oh, they're too old for this, I always say to them, well, that's your choice. You can be as old as you want to be.
I'm so glad to hear you say that because I massively agree. I think in a funny way, the music industry is ageless. And I do think it's whatever you put on yourself. I know some really old 30-year-olds. And I know some incredibly young 78-year-olds. And it really is about the person and about the approach and obviously a bit of luck with help and things like that. But I think if you've got that sort of mojo and that sort of hiss, you can go on and on. And some of the biggest acts in the world are older, much older. The best live touring acts are older musicians and older singers. It's fascinating to me.
It is. And you know, it's also weird for me though. And I saw this article 2 years ago and it's in the UK and it referenced females only. A couple of the radio stations, the bigger radio stations in the UK, they will not play any female artists who are over the age of 30 because they consider them to be no longer relevant. So a couple of years ago, Kylie came back with Padum Padum. And the
radio God, what a song.
Oh, it's brilliant. I love Mia Kylie. A lot of the radio stations wouldn't play it because she's 55, 56. But then it blew up on social media. And because of the social media blowing it up, it helped put that. So I think social media
and
the digital world has pushed past that a little bit. I mean, it's been going on for years. I also read the autobiography of Bananarama. In the 80s, they had turned 24 and the record label dropped them because they said they were too old at the age of 24. So it's been going on for decades and it's focused specifically on women, which is completely...
Well, it would. No. It's women. Women have to be the ingenue. You know, yes. You can't be the interesting older woman. I'm hoping we're changing that perception because what I'm finding is, you know, seeing kids of all ages at our shows, and I say kids of all ages, I mean 78-year-olds as much as 19-year-olds, yep. as much as 6-year-olds, just that energy and that connection to one another. And if someone's still got the goods, I mean, how does it matter how old they are? I don't understand it. And I'm hoping it is. Our perceptions are changing slowly. That's probably not quite clear enough.
Putting it out there, it will continue to. Do you guys continue to create new music or you focus on the old catalog?
You know, we hadn't created new music in a while. We've had some thoughts about, you know, an interesting sort of new song idea. And we've just, I guess what we've been doing is focusing on the live shows. The live show is something we love the most, especially since, you know, when COVID ended, just we got back out there as quickly as we could because that's our favorite thing to do. You know, so that is the focus, especially celebrating the 40-year milestone. New songs, absolutely, we are looking at that. We're also looking at lots of legacy projects, you know, sort of movie documentaries and musicals, which is, it's an interesting avenue to kind of go down. So we'll see where that takes us. I guess for me, I mean, what drew me to this industry was always the performance side of it. I always wanted to be on stage. And that's kind of what we're doing more than anything at the moment.
Okay, so what do you love about performing live?
It's a very good question because it terrifies me. But then I'm told that it's good to be nervous because it means you still take it seriously and enjoy it. I think it is that connection with an audience and obviously also with my bandmate. You know, on stage, we are genuinely silly. You know, it's 11 people, crazy energy, all of us different, all of us are nuts in our own way, coming together. And there's certain things we know are going to be exactly the same, but other things get changed up and... You know, I can't imagine just being on stage on my own. So it's the interaction with the band and then with the audience as well.
I'm that guy that's standing right up in front. I'm taking a couple of photos, a couple of videos, and I put my cell phone away. I notice these days that a lot of people are tweeting or videoing or posting and all these type of things with their phones. You referenced that connection from the person on the stage that is potentially seeing a bunch of phones compared to people's eyes. Do you not feel that the phones take away from the connection or it's just where society is at this stage?
I think it is where society is. You know, there's a compliment to be pad when people haul out their phone. It's like they think there's a big moment here or something. So it always, for instance, a special star, that will often happen. But I agree with you. It's that sense of, no, be with us in this moment. And I think is happening is people might initially, because there's a whole big funny thing now that happens with Special Star where the guys, you know, the brass guys rev everyone up and then people do put their phones away and go into like a singing and tapping frenzy. But it is that. I agree with you. We must watch ourselves with that, you know, being in the moment and connecting to one another is, it's all we have. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I know we're living in an interesting time with technology, especially with AI looming and, you know, obviously we need to make friends with all of these things, but they mustn't dominate us.
I love me a CD. I still budget for my CDs every month. I know being in South Africa, we don't have access to it hardly, if at all, because of all the shops closing down. I love the journey of the choice, the unpacking, the booklet, listening to song from one to whatever number. So some stats for you, which you may not know. So there's a massive uptick of physical overseas in the UK a couple of years ago, 5.9 million vinyls sold, the biggest since 1990. Last year, also in the UK, there's a basket of products. The government or whatever, they gauge exchanges on daily exchanges. And there needs to be a daily exchange for a product to be in the basket. And they monitor it for tax purposes. And because of the upsurge of CDs, CDs are now back in the basket. The research is showing that it's the teenagers, it's the younger kids diving into this world, not the, in inverted commas, older nostalgic people. Then we have Spotify, we have the streaming platforms. What are your observations of the landscape at the moment?
I just know that since I began in the industry, and since I began as a consumer, let's go back that far, I'll never forget saving up my pocket money to go and buy. I'd buy myself a 7-inch single every weekend. And I would maybe cycle to the shops or walk to the shops and buy my 7-inch single and come home and listen religiously to it. At the same time, I'd also occasionally buy albums. And then albums were recorded as journeys. I mean, Pink Floyd, The Wall, when I was a little girl, that was my first album I ever bought. I think the way we consume music now is just so different. I mean, myself included, I'm the first one to go, oh, but back in the day, I'd get the Pink Floyd album. I'd lie on the floor listening to it hours and getting lost in it. But I'm not doing that now anyway either. I'm also just downloading a song gratuitously that I heard. I'm constantly Shazamming things. Oh, what's that? What's that? I'm so delighted to hear that younger people are going back into the CDs and things like that. That makes me very happy. And I'm very surprised. I didn't actually know that. Obviously, I know about the vinyl uptick. And I love that. I find that very nostalgic. And listening to vinyls, that was very much my childhood. As a teenager, it was cassette. It was cassette for me. Came in later on CDs. I associated my parents with the vinyl thing.
Yeah.
But the CD, that's interesting. I had no idea.
For me, listening to it on an actual machine, a vinyl machine, a CD player, etc., the sound quality is like an envelopment of a hug of energy. Whereas you listen on Spotify, it's like flat and diluted, and it doesn't have the emotion compared to it. So absolutely.
I think it even goes down to something maybe as simple as the way in which, you know, putting that CD, I've still got a fantastic CD player and I've still got some great CD, where you sort of slide that thing in. It sort of it gets sort of sensually enveloped by the machine.
Yes.
You know, and it's sort of it slides in, and then next thing you've got this, you know, sort of explosion of sound. Whereas, you know, the Spotify, all of those things, it's instant gratification, certainly, but there's no sensuality to it. There's no tactile component to it.
I like that you're saying sensuality.
Sorry.
No, it's perfect.
Yeah.
I was laughing now because I interviewed, and one of my other guests on the show was Wigfield from the 90s. And she said, she said, I'm giggling as I'm saying this. She said, listening to music on digital is like making love without having an orgasm.
That's beautiful. Oh, I like that. I would never have come up with that.
It's the 40th celebration event coming up. There are going to be surprises, obviously, but what can we expect?
Well, you know, it's us having fun. It's the band in a happy space. We did a show, I think it was a month ago in KZN. And what was so particularly beautiful about the show is it's just the little kids that afterwards want to come and meet you. And so back to the show on the 14th. It's going to be, it's going to be nostalgic. Absolutely. It's also going to be very high energy. It's some surprises, quite a bit of AV, some little dancers on stage for certain songs, which I'm not even going to mention the names of the song.
Yes.
Because I think people who know Mango Groove know what I'm talking about. But it's just an explosion of energy and being South African, what it is to be South African in this crazy world right now. You know, we were hunting for a venue in Joburg. We are a Joburg band. We had to find something we felt that needed to be outdoors, where people can bring their entire family. They can relax, but they can also jump up and down and go crazy without offending people in the theater. So Walter Sisulu was the perfect venue for that. I think it's going to be a gorgeous day, you know, in the sunshine in Johannesburg, which we love.
So I'm going to be right there, right up in front.
Yay.
I'm going to take two or three photos, two or three videos, and then I'm going to be dancing with you.
I love it. You must please come and say hello.
Oh, I will. I love this game. I know if I had to ask you this question today, tomorrow, or the next day, or next week, Sunday, I know your answer will be different every time. I understand that and I recognize that. I'm not saying favorite. Okay. I'm saying top of mind. If you had to push play to five artists once we finish this conversation, like I said, top of mind, who would those five be?
ABBA, Nirvana, Pink Floyd, Ella Fitzgerald, Def Leppard.
I love that. And literally, if I had to ask you the question again now, you'd have another five. That's why I love this game.
You know, people say, what's your favorite song? What's your favorite movie? I just can't answer that. I could give you an endless list.
Exactly.
You know, and then it's all mood driven. That's the beauty of music.
It's the beauty of life to have choices.
There we go. The beauty and the terror.
I'm totally with you. The podcast is listened to throughout the world. As a final message, what would you like to say?
I feel very grateful to be in this crazy music industry thing, tap as it is, it's given me lots of joy, and connecting with people is huge. And yeah, I feel ultimately just grateful that I am celebrating 40 years with this crazy bunch of people. I hope we all get lucky enough to be able to say things like that about our lives.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Celeb Savant. Please follow Barrett on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook at Celeb Savant. That's CelebSavant.